Hi friends, RC here with Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor. Arturo Fuente Chateau Maduro, handmade in the Dominican Republic with a dark Connecticut broadleaf wrapper, giving us a rich, medium-bodied cigar with pleasant notes of coffee, vanilla, and sweet spiciness. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
Travel is here, and it can be tough on a vehicle. Whether it's dust or dirt, pollution or road grime, stop by Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market and Eureka Way in downtown Reading. They offer car wash packages starting at $11. Quick and Clean's gentle, automated pull-through wash includes a hand scrub pre-clean and a personal towel dry exit. Save money, save water at Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market and Eureka Way in downtown Reading.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
From all the fine art mediums that there are, photography has a claim to authenticity that other art mediums don't necessarily share. And I think photography has been particularly important to shaping even perceptions about historical events and social movements in America.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was Dr. Christina Lam Chikalova, Assistant Professor of Art here at Hillsdale College. She returns this week for another deeper conversation into the history of American art. More on that later on in the show. First, we're joined by Adam Kissel. He's Visiting Fellow for Higher Education Reform in the Center for Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation, also the co-author of the new book, Slacking, A Guide to Ivy League Miseducation. Adam, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
You recognize your co-authors on the book, Rachel Alexander Comber and also Madison Marino Doan. So three authors for this Slacking book that is now out. People see what's happening on college campuses these days, TV, and perhaps ask themselves, what the heck is going on there? And Slacking tries to at least in part answer that question. What the heck is happening on our college campuses, specifically our Ivy League schools?
Well, the moral and cultural rot that people perceive has a lot of its roots in the failure of the curriculum. The general education core curriculum across the Ivy League, with the one exception of Columbia University, uses a ways of knowing approach or a distribution requirements approach rather than having any content at its moral center or its academic center. What that means is that there's a Emersonian romantic view of what you're supposed to do in college, which is to pursue your dreams and your own values and have your own self-indulgent ideas take you where your education should go. In contrast to a classical conception of personhood and morality and core knowledge based on an articulation of what an educated person, especially an educated American as part of Western civilization, should know, not just be able to do, but also specifically know in order to function well in the world. On the one hand, if you take a romantic view and any history class that you feel like taking counts for any other, you have a feeling and worldview on campus that there is no knowledge worth having or most worth having in general for a human being or a citizen. And that influences the morality and the culture of the entire place.
The phrase core curriculum is used throughout Slacking, and you allude to it there in that first answer. For people who aren't familiar, we are familiar here at Hillsdale with the core curriculum or a core curriculum. What is it? Why is it so important to a well-rounded and a good education?
There's a famous line by Matthew Arnold, at this point more than 100 years ago, referring to the best that has been thought and said in the world. There's a certain amount of cultural heritage that has been passed on from previous generations to us that is not a particular doctrine that everyone must believe, but talk about it in terms of a great conversation. A great book out of the Western tradition addresses core issues for any human being and a citizen of any polity. And when you engage those fundamental questions at the origin of all learned inquiry, as the Committee on Social Thought at the University of Chicago puts it, then you're part of a multi-generational investigation of the best that has been thought and said and might be thought mm-hmm. and said. So a core curriculum engages you with the great texts that have engaged the hardest questions of identity and citizenship, role of government, religion, what to do with your life every day, how to handle relationships with other people. And it's a moral formation as much as an intellectual formation. That's at the core. And then you can go ahead and take some electives and you can specialize in a particular topic. But the core is what every educated person should have experienced.
Something that we talk about, too, is the fact that when students do take the same classes, read the same books, there exists a sense of community and, by extension, a sense of civility among the student body that perhaps does not when everyone is taking different courses, learning different things, reading different things. Is that a side benefit of also a core curriculum, the fact that perhaps there's a bit more civility among students and then perhaps as they go out into the world?
I wonder if it's not a side benefit, but part of the core of having that shared experience. When you engage in the world with someone else who's well-educated and you refer to something out of the Bible or American history or more broadly Western civilization, some of the great texts, and that other person understands you and understands the reference, you've connected with them in an important personal way, then being able to say, to take the next step, and say, so what about that Achilles versus Agamemnon problem at the beginning of the Iliad? Mm-hmm. And someone says, yeah, there really is a problem with trying to stand up for yourself against government authority. You can get to that next step of a civil debate because you have, in rhetorical terms, what's called a topos, a common place to start from to have a conversation. If you don't have a common place to start from, then you're in a lot more trouble. It's important to a core to have that ground for a civil conversation.
Adam Kissel with us. His book, Slacking, A Guide to Ivy League Miseducation. Adam, how long have these Ivy League schools, or at least most of them, had this distributional approach to education? When did they slide away from having a core curriculum?
Each university has its own story, but I would say a few things. One is through most of the history of classical education and higher education in general through the time of Ralph Waldo Emerson, so we're talking about the mid-19th century, there was a core set of information that was expected in higher learning. Emerson comes along, says, hitch your wagon to a star, the romantic style of education starts to take hold at places like Harvard, where electives enter the scene. So instead of everything being set out for you, you can choose your own adventure. That took a different form at different institutions, and it had already become such a new way of thinking that already by the 1930s, there was a general education movement to return to this idea of a general education that was suitable for all people getting a college education. The second stream that was hopefully addressed by the general education movement was the German university research model, in which people would specialize, do critical analysis at a deep level of engagement, and lose that generalist approach. It was a graduate student versus undergraduate approach, to put it in simple terms. So the general education movement was the answer to both of those trends. And then in the early 20th century, meanwhile, somehow at Columbia University, it was decided there should be a core, and somehow that core of Western civilization has persisted to this day. So Columbia has its own story. At some point in the mid-20th century, I don't remember the full story of Brown University, the open curriculum happened. The idea was it should be all electives. Choose the whole adventure for yourself. You can still have a major, but there's no core, maybe just some writing classes. So Brown also has its own story to tell separately from the rest of the Ivies.
We're talking with Adam Kissel. He's the co-author of Slacking, A Guide to Ivy League Miseducation. More details on specific Ivy League schools in just a moment. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Every day, your life is filled with choices. And when a health crisis happens, you need to be prepared to choose the best healthcare partner. That's when Shasta Regional Medical Center is there to answer the call above the rest. Ranked best in Reading and in the nation for patient safety and clinical excellence, you can be confident that when you choose Shasta, you are choosing superior care, safety, and excellence for you and your family. Choose Shasta at ShastaRegional.com.
This season, Hunter Roofing is stepping up to the plate. As proud sponsors of Colt 45's baseball, we're cheering on every home run and keeping your home protected. From storm repairs to full replacements, trust the pros who bring quality to every job. Hunter Roofing, where quality meets the sky. Support local, keep your home in winning shape, and root for the Colt 45s. Visit HunterRoofing.org today.
Don't miss Memory Lane's Timeless Treasures parking lot sale this Saturday. Rock bottom prices in the parking lot and 10, 20, up to 50% off in different areas in the store. Antiques, furniture, military, hunting and fishing, jewelry, home decor, clothing, knives, lamps, and so much more. Saturday the 14th, 9 to 2 at the Shasta Gateway Shopping Center in Anderson. Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage, and Collectibles. You'll love it.
Goldleaf Nursery is celebrating 50 years in business. Yep, 50 years. Seems like yesterday our nursery and landscape business was just a little seedling itself. But the truth is, we've been serving Shasta County for 50 years, growing shrubs, trees, and veggie plants since 1975. It's the 50th anniversary sale now, all through springtime. With all shrubs and trees and ground covers 1 gallon or larger, 30% off. We have a good selection of spring shade bloomers such as azaleas and camellias and many other sun-blooming plants to enhance your landscape in those sunny locations in the yard. This is the perfect time of the year to start preparing your vegetable garden. We have organic soils and fertilizers, including a full line of John and Bob's Organics, and we carry non-GMO seeds. So rest assured, you can have a healthy planting crop in your vegetable garden. All shrubs and trees and ground covers 1 gallon or larger are 30% off. If you have not been to Goldleaf Nursery, we invite you to check us out and see for yourself why we have so many customers tell us what a unique nursery we have. Goldleaf Nursery, 6186 Churn Creek Road, across from Tucker Oaks Golf Course and 1/4 mile from Airport Road.
Hi, it's Mark from Haven Humane Society. Are you looking to add to your family? We have puppies, kittens, small critters, and farm animals. Each year, we have thousands of amazing animals looking for homes come into our lives, and we hope to have them join yours. Follow us on social media and find our links on our website at havenhumane.org. Watch our weekly content on YouTube, like our Mark's Monday mashup, when we talk about what's going on and introduce you to our team and adoptable animals. Get involved. Volunteer. Thank you for all your continued support. Together, we are moving closer to our ultimate goal of a North State with no more homeless pets.
Attention veterans, did you know that Shasta College and Simpson University have veterans resource centers to assist you in your educational pursuits? These centers offer a wide range of support services, including financial aid, tutoring, IT support, and more. We understand the unique challenges that veterans face and are committed to helping you succeed. Our experienced staff is here to help you navigate the college experience and achieve your academic and career goals. Don't let anything stand in your way. This message is brought to you by Senator Maurice Johannesson, former Secretary of California Veterans Affairs.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300, a reputation for excellence since 1965.
Come.
on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram, talking with Adam Kissel, visiting fellow for higher education reform in the Center for Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation and co-author of the recent book, Slacking, A Guide to Ivy League Miseducation. In Slacking, Adam, each chapter covers a different Ivy League institution. Two outliers at the end we'll talk about in a minute, but these other institutions, almost all of them you look and you see there are, at Yale, for example, 298 courses to fulfill a writing requirement, and there are other schools with there are 300 courses to fulfill X requirement. How do you get to a point where a school says, yes, you can take any one of these 300 options and we'll deem you knowledgeable about that subject?
Well, the real answer is that they don't deem you knowledgeable about that subject. The history classes, for instance, using a ways of knowing approach, teach you to think like a historian. The history that you know is irrelevant so long as you know how to think like a historian, use some historical methods. The same is true in literatures, to think like a literary critic and theorist, not necessarily to know any particular literature. So this ways of knowing approach is what powers the distribution requirements, some of this, some of that, a little science, a little arts, a little humanities, and that's in the interest of the faculty, because not only do they not have to articulate what a person should know to be educated, but also any department can get a piece of it. Mm-hmm. There could be a history of music class to teach your history, for instance. Every department wants to get some people in seats and get some core curriculum students. They get maybe some tuition money kicked back out of that. So they're happy to have distribution requirements.
Slacking's the book. Adam Kissel, the co-author. There's a long-standing joke about these classes and majors that athletes take in colleges, you know, basket weaving, things like that. At Princeton, an Ivy League institution, you point out in Slacking that someone could, if he or she wanted, take care of some of these requirements by taking classes such as shoes and a perfect cup of coffee. And it's not just Princeton, there are ridiculous classes at all of these institutions. Anything else jump out to you as some of your favorite non-serious courses?
There's a lot of them. At Harvard, you can take, to meet your arts and humanities requirement, a course called Zombies, Witchcraft, and Uncanny Science. There's a lot of courses that are self-indulgent, tendentious, question-begging, very biased. Keep staying at Harvard, there's legitimacy and resistance in an unjust world. Hashtag abolish police, the politics of public safety in the age of social media, queer coming of age stories. Also, now say turning to Yale, there's a course called Pop Sapphism. There's a number of courses in pop culture, which you'd think that students of a certain age already know pretty well. Mm-hmm. Comparative settler geographies. A couple of my favorites are at Penn, decolonizing French food. So these go on and on, and we could spend a lot more time just naming the titles of courses. But if you read the course descriptions, you also can be as appalled or entertained as you like, from climate change to, again, so I don't know what to say about. Right. Well, we should talk about the other side of the story, too. So it's not all bad. A generation ago, the question was, is it still required that you take Western Civ, mm-hmm. U.S. history, and Shakespeare? But now, in our generation, the question is there even one class at an Ivy League university in those areas that's worth taking? And the answer often is yes, there's one, maybe two. So you can still get your course on Beowulf once in a while, mm-hmm. or your course on Shakespeare. It may even be a good one.
Yeah.
May even be taught well. There's a lot to make fun of, but there's still a few remnant courses.
And that's a point that you make in Slacking, which is at the conclusion of many of these chapters, you present two options. One, if someone wanted to kind of slide by and not challenge oneself. And a second option for more serious classes at each of these institutions. You do say, too, there are two outliers, and I wanted to talk briefly about both of them in the Ivy League, Brown and Columbia. Let's start with Brown first. So Brown has, you mentioned this previously, a different way, an open curriculum rather than general education requirements. What does that mean for students at Brown?
So at Brown, you still have to take enough credits to get a degree. So it's not an entire free-for-all where they pretend to teach, you pretend to learn, and at the end you get a degree. You still have to take at least 30 courses. There's 80 concentrations to choose from. You have to be in residence at least half the time, so 4 out of 8 semesters. And there's a writing requirement. Other than that, you're on your own to decide what you should study. That's what an open curriculum is. So in the book, we only look at the writing requirement because it is a requirement. And just like we said before, you could take Sex, Power, and God, a medieval perspective. You could take the racial politics of national culture, a course called How Can Activists Change the World? The Dynamics of Power and Resistance. There's some more interesting ones. You could take Shakespeare. You could take a course that includes Homer, Plato, Marco Polo, and et cetera. And then finally, about Brown, there is a first-year seminar that's optional. Race, Power, and Privilege is optional. There's about 80 choices for that. Same thing, right? So We're Asians could be the course you take for race, power, and privilege in that subject area. And then you could take Friendship in the Ancient World, probably a very respectable course. Mm-hmm. So the choices are be a slacker, and there's a million ways to be a slacker, or be a striver and follow the narrow path.
The other school that's the outlier, Adam, is Columbia. And one of the most stark statements in the book is there is no room for slackers at Columbia. They still have a core curriculum. I think a question people would ask, knowing that, but also seeing what's been happening, is how do you square that there is no room for slackers at Columbia with the protests, the anti-Semitism, all the goings-on that's happening on Columbia's campus these days?
It's a great question. There's fewer than 5,000 undergraduates on Columbia's campus. I was surprised when I learned that the total enrollment at Columbia is more like 36,000. So there's 30,000 graduate students on campus, half of them Chinese, half of them from other countries. So when you look at what is going on, I would guess that the agitators are mainly not just outsiders from Columbia, but mainly graduate students from other countries. The undergrads have core courses to take. The undergraduate body is just a small part. One of the jokes about Harvard is that Harvard University is really a hedge fund with a small undergraduate college attached. And so Columbia has some of that same characteristic, where it's a graduate institution of the world with a small undergraduate body.
Adam Kissel is visiting fellow for higher education reform in the Center for Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation, also co-author along with Rachel Alexander Comber and Madison Marino Doan of the new book, Slacking, A Guide to Ivy League Miseducation. Adam, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Scott, thanks so much for having me.
Up next, Dr. Christina Lamb Chikolova is back with us to talk more about the history of American art. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Join me for the first Thursday of every month at 6 p.m. for my show, North State Now. In this one-hour show, we cover what's happening in the music scene, theater, food, and arts. We get in-depth interviews with local business owners, musicians, actors, and authors. Listen in, tune in, call in, participate. Win tickets to concerts and theater productions. It's a lot of fun, and believe me, it keeps us going. Join me, your host, Linda Bott, or North State Now, the first Thursday, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, also streaming at KCNR1460.com.
Hi, this is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
When people ask me for a recommendation for a heating or air conditioning company, I always say Alliance Heating and Air. Why? Well, they've been taking care of our HVAC system for 14 years. Professional, friendly, and willing to go to the extra step for their customers. I have found no problem too difficult or too minor for them to repair. I recommend Alliance Heating and Air with no reservations. You can reach them at 530-221-2642 or online at homecomfort.org. And they have 24/7 emergency assistance. Alliance Heating and Air.
This is Colonel Danny Gillum, the host of Frontlines of Freedom, the nation's largest military news and talk radio show. We address the most pressing issues facing the security of our nation, our armed forces, our veterans, and their families. Please join us every Saturday morning from 6 to 8 on 96.5 FM and 1460 AM KCNR, your talk radio show.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Do you have a crazy schedule and can't seem to get to a class to qualify for your CCW, CCW renewal, or maybe learn to use that new firearm you just purchased? Consider a private class with NFI. Learn to shoot a handgun, rifle, shotgun, or even a BB gun. Classes are taught by an instructor that you choose on your dates and location. Give NFI a call at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and I'll see you at the range.
Hey, it's your liberty-loving Latino amigo, Rich Valdez, host of America at Night. Weeknights, we're letting you know what's happening live all across America. We'll have newsmakers and experts coming on, talking about the hot topics of the day. Plus, in our third hour, whatever you want to talk about with open phones across America, our nightly town hall. I look forward to hearing from you on the next America at Night with me, Rich Valdez.
Weeknights from 7 to 10 p.m. on KCNR.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. You can find our shows wherever you get your audio, but you can find them all at podcast.hillsdale.edu. Older episodes of this program, plus episodes of The Larry Arnn Show, Imprimis, The Hillsdale Dialogues, and the Hillsdale College Online Courses Podcast. Take our online courses in audio form at the Hillsdale College Podcast Network, podcast.hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Dr. Christina Lam Chikalova. She is Assistant Professor of Art at Hillsdale College. Dr. Chikalova, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We continue our conversation on the history of American art. How do we define American art? You spent time in the fall teaching an entire course on this question, so you're an expert. We deem you. How has American art been shaped by historical events, by social movements throughout our nation's history?
So this was a really good question and thought about it quite a bit. And I decided that I'm going to answer this question through one artistic medium, and that is going to be through the medium of photography, because from all the fine art mediums that there are, photography has a claim to authenticity that other art mediums don't necessarily share. And I think photography has been particularly important to shaping even perceptions about historical events and social movements in America. So one good example to start with here is the photographic sketchbook that was published by Alexander Gardner, but with the assistance of an army of photographers like Timothy O'Sullivan, who did a very famous picture called The Harvest of Death. This was taken at Gettysburg in 1863, you know, right after the battle had ended. I believe they showed up around like July 5th, so a lot of the bodies had not been interred yet, and one of the photographers here took his camera right onto the field. He put his camera very low to the ground and basically took a photograph on site of a lot of bodies of Union soldiers. Their shoes had been taken off. Their pockets had been strewn through. A lot of them were already bloated in death. And he took this picture that greatly drew attention to the calamity of the Civil War. You know, until now, when art has engaged with war, usually it's a painting, and it's a very heroic painting that paints war in this light of like pageantry. You know, it's heroic. It's wonderful. It's the greatest civil act that you could do. Well, maybe yes, this is true. But when you have a photograph of the war and a photograph of dead bodies, which is something we're very used to today, we live in a world saturated with images and violence, and all of this is quite normal. You know, just open up your app on the news and you'll see images like this on a daily basis, but that wasn't true for the 1860s in the United States. And so here we have an example of a photographer who is drawing attention to the war, but not necessarily highlighting the heroic aspects of it, but just the raw reality of war and death and essentially the consequences of war, especially when brothers are fighting brothers. You know, nobody's really a winner. And of course, the Battle of Gettysburg is the bloodiest battle in the history of U.S. history. So this was an interesting time when photography is now being used as a way to kind of draw attention to the severity of what is at hand.
Dr. Chikolova, this is really the beginning of what we call documentary photography. Who and what comes next for that aspect of American art?
That made me think, too, about Jacob Riis, who went into the tenements of New York City to use his camera as an instrument for social justice. And, of course, interesting about Jacob Riis is that he also figured out how to use, like, magnesium powder to make a flash of the camera. And so for the first times, he's kind of going into the deepest, darkest, dingiest places in New York City and kind of bringing to light what the plight is of America's immigrants. And so here too, another time where American art photography is kind of shaping perception about what is happening in our country at that time. And of course, also to, in essence, affect change. Dorothy Lange did a very similar thing during the period of the Great Depression. She was tasked to go out to California and kind of photograph a lot of migrant workers who had, for the most part, kind of fled the central part of the United States. There was the Dust Bowl, you know, all of that was going on. People were moving to California in search of work, and what they found was no possible living conditions, terrible working conditions. And so with her camera, Dorothy Lange kind of brought attention to the plight of these people. Famously, she has a picture of Florence Owens Thompson, a woman with her hand at her mouth and a child over her shoulder. You know, it was a very famous portrait that was then actually printed in the newspaper, widely circulated, and kind of brought attention to what was happening in the U.S. at this time of the Great Depression. Certainly helped to garner support for the New Deal at that time. Perhaps less dramatic is Ansel Adams' use of the camera. Well, it just depends on how you feel about the American landscape. But at the time, Ansel Adams was photographing, you know, it's coming off of the end of the height of the Industrial Revolution. And so he used his camera to draw attention to, like, the beauty of the American landscape and help to further the efforts of the National Parks Movement. Or Edward Curtis, around the same time, was photographing Native Americans and a dying way of life. And so I think when it comes to American art forms, the camera photography has been one of the most important mediums in shaping perceptions about historical events and affecting social movements as well.
Is there anything in particular we should say about the role of art in expressing and responding to the civil rights movement of the 20th century?
Yes. I feel like there are so many examples in this particular case, but when it comes to the civil rights movement, I think one person who's not really political in his art, but when he was, made some serious impacts, that would be Norman Rockwell.
Mm-hmm.
So he rarely did politicizing art, but if he did, it was pretty powerful. Like during, you know, just to go back in time a little bit, like during World War II, he did his Four Freedoms, Freedom from Want, Speech, Worship, and Fear. These were really powerful images that were in the Saturday Evening Post. And besides that, he didn't do anything too political, except for when he got a new job at Look magazine. They were putting out an issue in 1964 titled How We Live. They had somebody write an article, and they asked him to, in essence, come up with an image that fits with this theme of the issue, How We Live. And what he came up with was his famous problem, We All Live With, which is a depiction of Ruby Bridges on her way into her very first day of first grade at a school in New Orleans called William France Elementary School. So in this very powerful composition, what Rockwell does is he puts Ruby essentially in the center of the composition. In front of her are two federal agents. Behind her are two federal agents, which is all based on fact. This is how she literally walked into the school. But the way he frames everybody in the composition is that the only full figure is Ruby herself. The agents are kind of cut off at the shoulder. They are symbolically there. Behind Ruby is terrible graffiti on the wall, tomatoes that have been thrown up against the wall at her. And it's a really, really powerful image that through compositional choices highlights the kind of ideological absurdity of segregation at the time. This is just an adorable little girl dressed beautifully on her first day of first grade. It made me think about on social media today, you know, everyone posts their kids' first day of first grade picture, teacher name, favorite color, you know, all of these things. That was a very different experience for Ruby Bridges. And that's exactly what Norman Rockwell highlights in this painting that is just drawing attention to that absurdity of racial barriers at the time, which thankfully have been broken, and the absurdity of segregation in essence. Yeah. So very powerful work of art that highlights those themes without being in your face. It's really through his compositional choices.
Talking with Christina Lam Chikolova. She'll return in a moment. We'll talk more about the history of American art. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Have you ever wanted to unlock your musical potential? Cascade Curations not only has great music, art, and fashion, we also offer fun and exciting music lessons for all ages and skill levels. Whether you dream of playing the piano, guitar, drums, or vocals, our instructors will guide you every step of the way. With flexible scheduling and personalized instruction, you'll be playing your own tunes in no time. Don't just listen to music, create it. Call or text us at 530-255-4855 to book your first lesson. Cascade Curations, where we believe anyone can learn to play their own song.
Helicopter rides, airplane rides, classic cars, aircraft displays. It's all happening this Father's Day. Aviation Day, Sunday, June 15th, from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Benton Airfield in West Reading. Admission is free and parking is free. Sponsored by the Reading EAA. Come for a great breakfast. Put on by the Mount Shasta 99s from 7 a.m. to 11 a.m. Adults are $10. Kids from 5 to 12, $5. Kids under 5 are free. Aviation Day, 2025, Father's Day, Benton Airfield.
Hi, it's Mark from Haven Humane Society. Are you looking to add to your family? We have puppies, kittens, small critters, and farm animals. Each year, we have thousands of amazing animals looking for homes come into our lives, and we hope to have them join yours. Follow us on social media and find our links on our website at havenhumane.org. Watch our weekly content on YouTube, like our Mark's Monday mashup, when we talk about what's going on and introduce you to our team and adoptable animals. Get involved. Volunteer. Thank you for all your continued support. Together, we are moving closer to our ultimate goal of a North State with no more homeless pets.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300, a reputation for excellence since 1965.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Don't forget to follow us on X. We're at Hillsdale Radio for updated show and guest information. We continue our conversation with Dr. Christina Lam-Chakalova from our art department about the history of American art. Dr. Chakalova, are there distinct regional styles or themes in American art? Do they help reflect the unique characteristics of different parts of this country?
This is hard to answer, I would say. So yes and no. There are definitely certain art movements that are from different regional areas. You know, the Hudson River School starts out in and around the Hudson River, although I will say they end up going also to the American West. Here, what I really thought about in answering this question is how works of art themselves, perhaps not as a group, but individually, are reflecting unique parts about the American landscape. So I could think of both Native American and more modern American examples of art that do this. For example, the Cliff Palace. So some of us have heard of the Cliff Palace. It was constructed by Puebloans around the Four Corners area of the United States. It's a famous, like, city that's actually built into this kind of wonderful natural overhang there. It is beautiful. It offers fabulous views of the landscape. It's certainly interested in protection from the elements, but it's a very, very clever use of the pre-existing topography to build an architectural setting that is going to, like, benefit the inhabitants. So there are many different examples of Native American art that is really in tune, I think, with unique characteristics of different parts of the country. There are also more kind of modern examples that accomplish the same goal and have the same interest in mind that made me think of, like, Frank Lloyd Wright's Falling Water in Pennsylvania. Here, too, we're thinking about the natural topography, how to use it to the best of our ability to highlight its beauty, but also to be practical. That was a project that was for someone named Edgar Kaufman Sr. He had a department store in Pittsburgh. He was very wealthy. The idea was to be this kind of retreat from life in the city in Pittsburgh. There was a waterfall there, and what they commissioned him to do was, you know, build a house that has a beautiful view of the waterfall. But Frank Lloyd Wright said, oh no, I'm going to highlight the unique characteristics of this part of the country. I'm going to make the waterfall part of the house. And if you can't actually see the waterfall, you'll hear the waterfall because it's going through the homes. He tried to make all these different kind of alternating floors. What's typical of his architecture is that it constantly oscillates between an interior and an exterior space. If you're in the interior, you can see the exterior. If you're on the exterior, you can transition easily into the interior. And so here, too, an example of architecture that's really interested in highlighting unique characteristics about the setting in which it is placed. And there are many other examples of this as well.
How have American artists helped to contribute to the development of new techniques, new mediums, new styles in the art world?
Well, this takes me back to that point about American art is very ambitious, and I thought about the Gilded Age and the aesthetic movement, which is something that really originated in Britain, responds to the Industrial Revolution and the age of the mass-produced cheap object that fills the role but might not be aesthetically pleasing. And as the Industrial Revolution kind of chugged along, there started to be fewer and fewer artisans who could still really have these outstanding skills and techniques to create beautiful objects that could be at once utilitarian but also works of art. So this made me think about the aesthetic movement in the United States, artisans like Francis Kohler, perhaps more famously like Tiffany, all of these artists working in and around New York, thinking about kind of uniting art with labor once again, uniting the artist and the artisan, thinking about Renaissance jewelry, for example. Francis Kohler looked closely at Renaissance jewelry and thought, hey, in this day of the mass-produced object, you know, maybe some people don't want that mass-produced thing, and I'm going to revive the beautiful and everyday objects that are about quality but also about utility. At this time, a lot of techniques are at risk of being lost because people don't have time, energy, or resources to fund certain art forms that have been around for hundreds of years. So I think it's really interesting to think about American artists working in and around New York, especially, or Boston East Coast artists at the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century, who worked very hard to bring back to life fabulous art forms, which, again, had been around for hundreds of years, with kings and queens commissioning beautiful jewelry and then kind of fell by the wayside. So I think that if they didn't contribute to new techniques, they certainly did. But one of the things that I think is important to highlight is that they helped us not lose endangered art forms, especially when it comes to like jewelry making, mm-hmm. glass making, going back to Tiffany or even thinking about John Lafarge, you know, who's commissioning stained glass anymore? It's not the church for beautiful Gothic cathedrals. It's a technology that was at risk of being completely lost. And then you have these ambitious Americans who start to take these ancient art forms and transform them into something new and practical, even for the modern day.
Talking with Dr. Christina Lamb Chikalova about the history of American art. Put you somewhat on the spot here, I guess. If we look back through American art for innovative, groundbreaking artists, great artists, you mentioned a few names through our conversation, but if you're putting together a Mount Rushmore of American artists, who are those that people should seek out and perhaps learn more about to help tell the story of American art?
So that's a really hard question and a loaded question. I think that on the one hand, all American art movements are important and they're all part of the whole. I will take a moment to highlight a little bit more perhaps the Hudson River School of Painters. There are many artists here. Some of them are American born. Some of them were actually trained and born in Germany, like at the Academy in Düsseldorf, and they brought their skills back to the United States where they have a great audience, very interested in representations of the American landscape. I think that the Hudson River School is so important to highlight, and it's artists like Thomas Cole, Albert Bierstadt, George Innes. There are really so many more. I can hardly name them all. What they did for Americans, especially those who are working in industrial cities around the turn of the century, was to bring glimpses of the beauty of the American landscape into the city and give them an opportunity to interact with something that's beautiful that they know about that they might not actually be able to see themselves. And so today we live in this world saturated by images. We're very used to just Googling something. We all have an impression of what Hawaii looks like because we've all seen a picture of it before.
Right.
In the early 20th century, you don't really have those kinds of opportunities. And what the Hudson River School did was to bring that into the cities, and landscape painting took on a very unique character in the United States that is just not comparable to any other place where landscape painting became popular. I also work in non-Western art. You know, landscape painting in China or Japan has a completely different goal in mind than in the American landscape. So I think the Hudson River School is innovative, groundbreaking, not just for capturing the American landscape, but also for, in a way, preserving it as a way it once looked before the Industrial Revolution. That makes me think of like George Innes, who painted Niagara Falls. And what he ended up doing was taking out all of the modern factories that had been built along the falls to take advantage of kind of the water, the power from the water there. He painted out all of those factories that were around the American landscape, and the Hudson River School helped not only to expand a love for the beauty of the landscape, whether New York and the Catskills, whether it was the West, they also brought attention to Americans that this is at risk of being lost. And I think without the Hudson River School of Painters and their efforts, like maybe we would never even have the National Parks Movement that we would have had today. So I think their impact is particularly long lasting.
Dr. Christina Lam Chikalova, she is Assistant Professor of Art at Hillsdale College, as we talk about the history of American art and how to define it. Thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you, Scott.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Adam Kissel, his new book, Slacking, A Guide to Ivy League Miseducation, and Dr. Christina Lam Chikalova from our art department here at Hillsdale. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
I'm Steve Coburn, proud owner of Country Air Pet Resort here in Reading. I invite you to come and take a tour of my revitalized pet resort. Our goal here at Country Air is to make sure your pet can relax and have a healthy, happy time away from home. With friendly, caring people, lots of fresh air and exercise, good healthy food, and plenty of pampering. There are no small cages here. What we offer are large temperature-controlled runs and spacious exercise yards that are great for fun and socialization. We even offer daycare. Cats are treated to a two-room apartment plus playtime in our playroom. So stop by and take a tour of the best. You and your pet will want to come back to Country Air Pet Resort, where our motto is, we treat your pets as if they were our own. Country Air Pet Resort, 549-3335.
The Ramsey Show.
You actually can help people, and you don't help them by giving them a government program. You help them by showing them the way out. People love me enough to put their arm around me and show me a different way. I didn't figure it all out in my own head. So there's a power to hope. That's not some kind of false panacea positive thinking way. It works. You can't positive think your way into everything, but you can't negative think your way into anything.
Listen weekdays at noon on KCNR, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio station.
At the Community Foundation of the North State, we believe strong communities start with generosity and connection. As a grant-making public charity for over 25 years, we link people who care with causes that matter, supporting education, the arts, health, and more across the North State. Together, we're creating a lasting impact right here at home. The Community Foundation of the North State. Local giving, powerful results. Visit cfnorthstate.org to learn more. A proud sponsor of the Reading Colt 45s.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. She had minor damage to her rear bumper. I wrote her an estimate. Later, I received a call. The lady responsible for the damage wanted to pay for the repairs out of pocket. Her insurance agent told her a claim would raise her rates for years. With our experience in the claim process, I explained to her most insurance companies would forgive a claim if the cost was below a minimum amount. I suggested she contact her insurance agent and have them review her policy. She called back very excited. It appeared her policy did extend forgiveness. They would pay for the repairs, and she wouldn't be charged with a claim or have to pay a deductible. The accident would not cost her a thing. She was very pleased. Good thing the vehicle owner came to the right place for repairs. We all pay a lot for insurance. Choosing Coachmaster will ensure you get the most for your money. Let this experience work for you. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.